Good morning. Yesterday, I learned the real reason why I'm here. Unwittingly, during my life, I have obeyed the five commandments of Leo Eisaki. And in order to show my independence of the famous professors who have preceded me this morning, I have taken off both jacket and tie. Now, nonlinear optics, for those who are involved with the field or who have read about it, is generally considered to have started in 1961, when Peter Franken at the University of Michigan transformed red light quanta into ultraviolet quanta at exactly twice the frequency, exactly half the wavelength. However, I want to show you that for any history, there's always a prehistory. And we can trace back the origins of nonlinear optics to the preceding century. What does the word nonlinear mean? It means that the response of a material, atoms, molecules, crystals, liquids, is not a linear function, not proportional to the applied force. The applied force is proportional to the electric field amplitude in the light wave. And so linear optics is concerned with the linear response, the polarization proportional to the electric light amplitudes. And in fact, the basis for linear optical properties was laid by Lorentz, H.A. Lorentz, who made this model of harmonically bound electrically charged particles, the electrons, and how they vibrate when subjected to the alternating light field in the light wave. And he could compute the dispersion and the index of refraction of materials with that model. Now, if he had allowed for a slight anharmonicity in the binding of the electrons, he could have discovered nonlinear optics at the turn of this century. And indeed, the electrons are not strictly harmonically bound. In fact, the electrons are bound in the Coulomb field of the molecular core or atomic core around which they describe their orbits. So they are subjected to the force of a Coulomb field that drops off as 1 over r squared and is certainly not proportional to r, the distance of the electron from the center. So clearly, a better model for the electrons is enharmonically bound, and these enharmonicities show up at high light intensities. And just the same way as a musical instrument, when it is excited too much by blowing too hard on an organ pipe, you get harmonic distortions. Exactly the same thing happens to electrons in atoms, molecules, crystals, liquids, when they are subjected to a very strong light field. The dimensionless quantity that governs these processes is the parameter which is the ratio of the electric field amplitude in the light wave to the electric field that is responsible for the binding of the electron in the atom. That latter field, the Coulomb field, atomic Coulomb field, is on the order of 10 to the 8 volts per centimeter. And you start seeing nonlinearities even if you have electric field amplitudes of only a few volts per centimeter, then that dimensionless parameter is small, but still the effects are observable. So why did this all happen in 1961? For two reasons. That in 1960, the first laser was realized by Maiman. And the other reason is that there is a history of other nonlinear effects. And there are really two legs on which nonlinear optics stands. One is a leg with magnetic nonlinearities, which I'll trace first, and the second leg is one of electric nonlinearities during the preceding century. So if I may have the first slide, and the room has to be darkened. More than 100 years ago, people used ferromagnetic materials in transformers to get power engineering and acoustic stuff in inductances and so on. And everybody has seen this basic ferromagnetic hysteresis loop of the magnetization, which is not proportional to the magnetic field, but has a curve like this. This hysteresis loop is of extreme importance. It's clearly a nonlinear response, but it leads to a bistability, and ferromagnetic domains can either point parallel to the field or anti-parallel and can be switched. And of course, that's the basis of all our magnetic recording and data storage in computers and so on. Enormous application of this nonlinearity, a simple magnetic bistability. The next slide shows a second nonlinearity. This is a paramagnetic salt as a function of applied magnetic field. And what is plotted here is the dimensionless quantity, the Bohr magnetic moment times the field H divided by KT. And if you go to high fields and very low temperatures, you find that you don't have a proportionality anymore, but you get what is known as paramagnetic saturation. All the little elementary magnets get aligned with the field, and of course, the magnetization cannot increase beyond that point. The J infinity curve is the classical curve due to Weiss. Then there is the curve J as a half, which applies to the two-level spin system that Professor Ramsey already discussed. And here, all the elementary spins are pointing in the same direction. And that's the maximum magnetization you can induce. I now jump 50 years. This was about 1910. I now jump to 1945, 46. The next slide, which you can't read, but these are the Bloch equations. This is a famous paper by Bloch of Physical Review, 1946. And you see here the magnetic response of a magnetic spin system, a two-level system, due to a resonant magnetic field, in a very similar way as happens in the cesium atomic clocks. But note that the applied field, which magnitude H1, the RF field, also occurs here in the denominator in a term that's called the saturation term. This saturation should not be confused with the previous one. In the previous one, we had a saturation because only one level was occupied of the two levels. That really corresponds to the limit of zero temperature. Here we have saturation because the RF resonance field produces many rapid transitions between the two levels. And eventually you wind up with a state where the population of the two levels is exactly equal, according to a Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution function that happens in the limit of infinite temperature. At that point, the susceptibility of the material approaches zero, and it is saturated in that sense. The susceptibility goes to zero. Now, the next step is a very simple one from the point of view of the human mind, but had enormous implications. And what we are going to do is we are going to saturate two levels, but there is a third level or a fourth level in between. And let's look what happens in that case. Next slide. You can't read this, so this is from my page from my notebook, but the next slide shows a clearer picture. And concentrate on these bottom four levels. They correspond to the chromium ion in sapphire, that's a ruby. And the chromium spin is three halves and has four levels in the microwave field. And you can tune these levels by changing the direction of the magnetic field and its magnitude with respect to the crystallographic axis of the ruby. And now we apply a saturating resonance field between levels 2 and 4. So the populations of level 2 and 4 become equal. Now, level 3 what population it's going to have. It's like a person who has two lovers and is in a difficult position. And note that I don't have to specify the sex of that person. If it likes to be in thermal contact with level 4, level 3 will get a higher population than level 4 because it's lower in energy, and according to Maxwell Boltzmann, it will have to have assume a higher population in thermal equilibrium. But since the pump had made populations between 2 and 4 equal, I would have a higher population in level 3 than in level 2. That is very remarkable. It corresponds to a negative temperature, one might say, that an energy level with higher energy has a higher population. What I've drawn here is the other case, that the person with the two lovers is more in love with level 2. And consequently, it is in thermal equilibrium with level 2, and therefore level 3 gets a lower population than level 2 because level 3 is higher in energy. But the pump had made the populations of 4 and 2 equal, and therefore 3 has a lower population than level 4. And therefore, if we now apply an RF field resonant at this frequency, nu 4-3, I produce more transitions down than up, because 4 has a higher population than 3. And that means that instead of resonance absorption, I get resonant emission, stimulated emission. And MASER stands, word coined by Professor Townsend's group, microwave amplification by stimulated emission of radiation. And that is the basis of microwave solid-state MASERs. Now, in the same slide, since I have it here, note a break in the vertical energy scale by a factor of 10,000. And here are other energy levels of the ruby, of the chromium ion, in the visible region. And that's why ruby gets a red color. It has the red color because it absorbs the blue and green. And now you can apply a light field that pumps up to these very high levels, these bands in the blue and green, and then you have these sharp levels here, the E and 2A levels, and they now get a higher population than the population in these ground state levels. And now you get a laser mechanism. Now you get stimulated emission at this wavelength, 6,943 micron, because the population in these levels is now higher than the population in these levels. And you get laser action. Of course, the experimental execution is very different in the microwave region than in the optical region. And let me briefly remind you of that. Next slide. Here you see a microwave cavity which is tuned to two frequencies, to the saturating of two levels, and then a weak signal comes in from an antenna that looks into interstellar space, and it gets amplified in here at the lower frequency. And these ruby masers were used, next slide, by Penzias and Wilson, and they put that maser here in the focus of this horn antenna, and they observed the 3 Kelvin background of the cosmic radiation, the background of the Big Bang, with the ruby maser. Now, the next slide shows the Maiman ruby laser. According to the recipe of Townes and Shalhoff, he built an optical resonator by having plain parallel ends silvered. This side was not completely silvered, so you could get some light out. Here is the flash lamp that pumps up to these optical levels I've shown you, and you get the inversion of population of the R levels, and out comes this laser beam characterized by high definition in frequency and directionality to the stimulated emission process. You see, very simple physical arrangements, but very clearly understood. Yet one can do very good physics with these things, although the scale is a factor 10 to the 10th or more smaller than the machines you heard described by Professor Taylor. Now, this is one leg. This is the leg that started with magnetic nonlinearity And it led to the laser, which is essential to get high light intensities for nonlinear optics. But now we still have to discuss the nonlinear electric properties. And here I go back again to the last century. Next slide. This is the Pockels effect. Could I have the next slide? Maybe I've skipped one slide. No, yeah, I'll start with this slide. That's good. There is such a thing as a nonlinear free energy, which is proportional to the light intensity, but also proportional to an applied dielectric field. And Pockels observed that the index of refraction of a piezoelectric crystal changes linear with an applied electric field. And this constant chi 2 times EDC corresponds immediately to a change in the index of refraction proportional to the applied DC electric field. And you can see it this way. If you differentiate with respect to that E star like this, you get the polarization at the light frequency omega, and you see it's not just proportional to the light field amplitude, but also proportional to the applied DC field. And that led to the Pockels effect. And Pockels' merit was that he had shown that this was not a mechanical effect. Previously, people said, well, in the piezoelectric crystal, if you apply an electric field, you get a mechanical stress, and then you have an elasto-optic effect. But he showed that this effect was much bigger and is of purely electric origin, which is important for the continuation of the argument. Now, why call this the beginning of nonlinear optics? That becomes clear at the preceding slide. Could you go backward one? Bitte rückwärts. Nochmal zurück. Yeah. When I differentiate with respect to the DC field, you get a DC polarization. And you see the DC polarization is proportional to the light intensity. And this was hailed as a new effect in 1962 as the rectification of light. But it's really not new. It's exactly the same constant that occurs in the Pockels effect. And the people who got that DC rectification, Franken and Bass, didn't realize what they had. But if this is nonlinear optics, certainly the Pockels effect is equally nonlinear optics. In a similar way, the photoelectric effect is real a nonlinear optic effect. And it's proportional to the intensity, to the square of the light amplitude. And you may say, well, that is sort of trivial. But it becomes less trivial if you have two light beams with slightly different frequencies. And then this term becomes E omega times E star omega prime. And you get a term at a difference frequency, omega prime minus omega, and you really see that modulation in the photoelectric current. And that is very important for many measurements. So the photoelectric effect, known since the turn of this century, is also a nonlinear optic effect. Next slide, and one ahead. Thank you. Yeah, this is from a well-known textbook by Yariv, and it shows you microwave modulation of light, which was done in the 50s. You put your piezoelectric crystal in a waveguide, and it's subjected to an microwave electric field, and you get sidebands on the light. You create the sum and difference frequencies of the light field and the microwave field. It's just a frequency modulation of the Pockels effect. It's as simple as that. And in this sense, the Franken experiment becomes a very simple one. What you say is the light field modulates the crystal at its own light frequency. And if you modulate light at the light frequency, you get twice the light frequency and you get rectification, you get zero. Omega plus omega and omega minus omega. And in that sense, the Franken experiment is very simple. Next slide shows you the outlay, the ruby laser. You get rid of all the extraneous light by going through a solution of copper sulfate. Only the red light gets through. Here is a crystal, quartz, KDP. Then you only transmit, this transmits the red. Here is the copper sulfate solution that absorbs all the visible light, but only passes the ultraviolet light at twice the frequency, and you measure it in a photocell. A very simple experiment. And the next slide shows a spectacular result that the red ruby light is transformed in this KDP crystal to an ultraviolet beam, which the photographic plate sees as blue smoke. In Franken's earliest experiment, he didn't have such a powerful UV beam. He only transformed 1 in 10 to the 12 red quanta to ultraviolet quanta. But the laser pulse had 10 to the 18th quanta, a ruby laser pulse, about a few tenths of a joule of light energy. And he still got about 1 million UV quanta out of that. Electrical engineers would say that's a harmonic distortion of minus 120 dB. Very small distortion, but very readily observable. This is the arrangement I showed previously. However, historically, next slide, Franken's experiment was done with an old-fashioned Hilger spectrometer with a photographic plate. Photographic plate was sensitive only to the ultraviolet, but there was so much red light that you got a big spot at the red frequency. And here, where this arrow is a little dot, which you don't see. And that was the UV light. Now, why don't you see that UV dot? It was very carefully removed by the editorial office of Physical Review Letters as a little blemish. But the most remarkable thing is, an erratum was never published. Everybody believed it, whether the spot showed up or not, and all the people who had a ruby laser could immediately reproduce it. There was absolutely no question about it that the field of nonlinear optics had been come to life. And in those days, if you had a ruby laser, it was very easy to find new nonlinear optic effects, and they follow in quick succession. I'm not going to enumerate them here. Two photon absorption, stimulated Raman effect, stimulated Brillouin, quadratic Kerr effects, self-Stark shifts, etc., etc. In fact, what we did at Harvard was the following, which I'd learned from my stay in Leiden. They told that Camaleonis had liquefied helium in 1908, and then he repeated all the textbook physics experiments at liquid helium temperatures. So he measured the resistance of metals at liquid helium temperatures. He found superconductivity, got the Nobel Prize. And then at Harvard was a colleague, Professor Bridgman, and he measured all physical quantities at high pressures. And he got the Nobel Prize for his high pressure work in the late 40s. So what we did is we took a textbook of Born and Wolf in optics, and at every paragraph we asked, what happens at high intensities? And one example is shown in the next slide, that you have here a nonlinear optical mirror. It's a crystal of gallium arsenide immersed in water. And here is the ruby beam coming in. It gets reflected, well-known law of reflection. But you get a second harmonic beam that may come out in a different direction, as indicated here. And you can measure the polarization and intensity properties. And that leads us to a comparison, next slide, of the development of linear optics and nonlinear optics. Now, that law of reflection, which is simply the following, is due to a Hero of Alexandria, says first century. I've forgotten whether it was BC or AD, but from our perspective, that doesn't make any difference. So here you have a mirror, here you have point A, here you have point B. A light beam gets via the mirror from A to B. And Hero showed that that is the shortest path. And in the same frame of mind as Newton, about whom we heard yesterday from Professor Sundar Sekhar, Hero of Alexandria writes, why would nature do anything in vain? In other words, why would light make a detour if it doesn't have to? And so it's a first example of an extremum principle in physics. And that leads to the law that the angle of incidence and the angle of reflection are the same. Then 16 centuries later, the law of refraction, known as Snell's law. Snell, I'm happy to say, was a Dutchman. He was a professor of mathematics in Leiden. But he was interested in the mathematics of trigonometric functions. And he showed for the first time that it wasn't the ratio of the angles of incidence and refraction that was constant, but it was the ratio of the sine of these two angles that were constant. And he had tables of sine functions and so on. And that's how Snell's law originated. Then it took another two centuries before Fresnel discussed the intensity and polarization properties of these reflected and refracted beams. And in a few months, Peter Pershing and I generalized all these things to the nonlinear case. And I showed you the example of nonlinear reflection. I don't want to brag about this, because the big thing is that in between here lived a person by the names of James Clerk Maxwell. And when you use Maxwell's equations, but just put in the appropriate nonlinearity in the constitutive relationship between P and E, between D and E, everything rolls out automatically. In fact, it was the same Lorentz who I mentioned before, who in his PhD thesis in 1878 derived all these laws on the basis of Maxwell's equations for linear optics. That was a great accomplishment, because these laws were derived by other considerations, not based on Maxwell's equation. Now, finally, you come to the last chapter of Born and Wolf, and that chapter is called conical refraction. Now, I don't know how many people in the audience have heard about conical refraction. It is a very academic subject. It only occurs in crystals with orthorhombic symmetry or less, the so-called biaxial optical crystals. And those two peculiar directions are such that if the wave vector of the light wave is parallel to one of those directions, there is an infinity of pointing vectors associated with that, and these pointing vectors lie on a cone. And so the light intensity you see coming out is a cone of light rather than birefringence, which would be just two rays. Well, that is all described in the last chapter of Born and Wolf. But in 1883, Hamilton predicted that, and Hamilton became famous, not because of Hamiltonians. He became famous because he predicted conical refraction. Hamiltonians came later. And it was considered so important that another person working in Ireland, in Dublin, within half a year, demonstrated these cones in a natural crystal of aragonite. And it was considered the triumph of the propagation ellipsoids of Fresnel's equations in anisotropic media. Now, here, the nonlinear development was much slower. We predicted second harmonic conical refraction in 69. But all the big laboratories, industry, other institutes of technology, they were all very busy making practical nonlinear optical devices. And nobody cared anymore about an academic subject like conical refraction. So Anita Schell, now and Mrs. Sorokin, had plenty of time to very carefully show the existence of the nonlinear analog there. That took about 8 years. The next slide very quickly shows you these what you expect. You expect a cone and a ray. The next slide shows you another cone and another ray. And the following slide are these experimental results on nonlinear refraction. You see a cone and a dot, and here you see another cone and a dot. Well, so much about history. Let's now have a very brief look. How much time do I have, Mr. Chairman? No. Some minutes. All right. That's all I need. Next slide. Many people are very busy making new nonlinear optical materials and the quantum well structures, which were already mentioned by Professor von Klitzing, are also very important in nonlinear optics. Photorefractive materials, I won't discuss. Organic polymers, I won't discuss. Liquid crystals, I won't discuss. But I will say a few words about glass fibers. The nonlinearity in glass is very small, but glass fibers can be very long. In fact, they stretch for 10,000 kilometers under the great oceans of this world, the Atlantic and the Pacific. And they are used for optical communications. And light, even of low intensity, gets concentrated in a glass fiber with a diameter smaller than a human hair and propagating over 10,000 kilometers, nonlinear effects become important and have to be dealt with. The next slide shows you some uses of nonlinear optics, practical things, harmonic conversion to the UV. One can also make difference frequencies. And with nonlinear optics, you can get laser-like beams anywhere from the IR to the vacuum UV. You can also make very short pulses, which are based, again, on nonlinear absorption. They are really based on this saturation in a two-level system. If the two energy levels belong to a dye, you say the dye gets bleached because the absorption of the dye disappears when the upper level and the lower level of the electronic system in the dye have equal population. That is the phenomenon of bleachable dyes. And these bleachable switches are used in making ultra-short pulses. I'll come to number five in a minute. Next slide. We have heard about time this morning, and Professor Klitzing showed a logarithmic scale, length scale. I'd like to show you a logarithmic time scale. Here is the lifetime of the universe, 10 billion to 15 billion years, and that's 10 to the 17 seconds. Here is a femtosecond pulse. With these nonlinear techniques, one can make light pulses that last only 10 to the minus 14 seconds. That's about 10 optical periods. In fact, the record is 4 femtoseconds, 4 optical periods. And what I want to show you is that you reach here again a new realm of physics. Look, the minute is about here, halfway. And so the minute is the geometric mean between the lifetime of the universe and the femtosecond pulse. There is a new field here of femtochemistry and femtobiology. And you can explore here the spectroscopic properties on a time scale where intermediate transients of the chemical reaction can be studied. But I will only give one physical example of these short pulses, and those are the solitons in optical fibers. Last slide. This is the propagation of a pulse through 10-kilometer long fiber in the laboratory. 10 kilometers long. And you see that this pulse essentially propagates without change in shape, which is remarkable because, as Professor Lamb mentioned, if you build a wave packet, it starts to disperse and spread out. These optical pulses, the solitons, don't spread. They don't spread because the dispersion in group velocities is exactly compensated and in a stable manner by feedback, which you get as a solution of a nonlinear Schrödinger equation, that the group velocity dispersion is exactly compensated by the intensity-dependent index of refraction, the self-phase modulation of the light wave. And people have since shown that these pulses can be propagated over 1,000,000 kilometers. Now, 1,000,000 kilometers is 10 to the 14 optical wavelengths. And these solitons are so remarkable. I don't need the slides anymore. Just the lights. Just in time. That they propagate for 10 to the 14 wavelengths. The soliton waves here are really striking. And it means that you can propagate 10 to the 11, easily 10 to the 11 of these pulses per second along the optical fiber. And that means that you can transmit 10 to the 11 bits of information in a second anywhere in the world, across oceans, continents, and wherever you have an optical fiber, you can send these pulses. Now, 10 to the 11 bits is the information content of the Encyclopedia Britannica. This amount of information can in principle be sent anywhere in the world between any two points connected by an optical fiber. And it's on that note I want to end. It is very gratifying to see that this example of lasers and nonlinear optics are leading to very important improvements in optical communications. Thank you very much.